we have a very special guest with us this time around, dealing with a topic that we haven't yet dealt with here on Beef Banter. And that has to do with ALS and Michigan hockey. How are the two tied together? Well, October 26th is a very special Michigan Hockey ALS Awareness Game. And joining us right now, we have to talk about this terrible disease, is Dr. Stephen Gaussman, who is the director of the Multidisciplinary ALS Clinic, associate professor of neurology in the neuromuscular program at the University of Michigan. And hanging out with him today is Matt Trevor, who is the communications director of the ALS Center of Excellence. And gentlemen, welcome to Beeves World. Nice to have you along.
Thanks so much for having us. We really appreciate it.
Everybody likes to know how one ends up in Beeves World. So, you know, why don't you tell us very quickly how you guys all ran into each other?
Sure. So, as you mentioned, this tonight actually is the ALS Awareness Game with Michigan Hockey. And I was invited to do an interview on the coaches show this week, and Jay was at the show, and we just started chit-chatting and thought it'd be great to continue our conversation.
And Matt, explain how you got on board, too. This is actually a good one, so.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, a couple of years ago, I was the director of hockey. Just a few months ago, I was the director of hockey operations. And over the last few years, we created this ALS awareness game. As we just said, this is the third year of it. Sadly, one of our Michigan hockey players, Scotty Matska, was diagnosed with ALS back in 2014. And as he started telling his story to his friends and former teammates and coaches, we brought up among the Michigan staff, we should really do something to help Scott, help his family, and also bring awareness to the disease because it's such an important thing, and the Ice Bucket Challenge had happened a year or two prior to that. So I got to meet Dr. Gaussman and Dr. Feldman here at Michigan Medicine, Michigan Neurology, and we've built this really strong base, strong event to spread awareness about the event and help people understand more about the disease and what it how it affects people.
Yeah, just to follow up on that, that's Scotty is, yes, he's the My Turn guy, and Kathy and I will post links with Scotty's story online. He's got a great web page. But My Turn, yes, that's Scotty Master, number 10 from the Michigan hockey program over 20 years ago.
And he's been an amazing advocate for ALS and really raising awareness and bringing this more to the public attention. It's desperately needed for ALS, and he's been tremendous at that and connecting people to resources to improve independence and quality of life and doing things like the connections with Michigan hockey to say, hey, this is a disease that needs more attention and more awareness, and he's really been a champion of that.
Yeah, an incredible point, and Matt brought this up to me. Jim Ballantyne, who played here in the late 80s, also got ALS, really great, well-known guy. I knew him really well. It was tight to Jerry the Barber from coaching four. He died from the same disease in the 90s, so this is the second guy that we know of that from U of M hockey that has dealt with this.
Yeah, it's certainly something, Steve, just a quick thing. It was something that Coach Berenson was really passionate about. I know Jim B and his classmates really rallied around him when he got the disease, and they had him out, and the Ballantyne family was out a few years ago for the first ALS awareness game. So Coach Berenson was the one that really helped push this and get this going, and he wanted to know, you know, what can we do, and we're going to see Coach tonight at the game, and we're going to have some more conversations with him because he wants to know, you know, what can he do from a, you know, a talking perspective, from a fundraising perspective, you know, how can you help help people do the research and help the people who are suffering through it right now.
You brought it up, Matt. Doc, with ALS, basically explain to the people out there who don't know what ALS is and where are we going, what are we trying to do, how can we treat, if you tell me, God forbid, I have ALS today, how do we treat this? What's the plan, so forth? Go ahead.
Yeah, great question. So I think it's important to start at the beginning. And ALS also really is known as Lou Gehrig's disease in the United States and other countries. People refer to it as motor neuron disease. The full term is amyotrophic lateral sclerosis. It's a disease that affects what we call motor neuron cells. And what I tell my patients is that you have two populations of these motor neuron cells. There's one area in the brain and there's one area in the spinal cord. And these are really the cells that essentially tell our muscles how to move and tell our muscles to move. And for reasons that we don't entirely understand, for really, really complex mechanisms, these cells die off. And the connections between these cells and the muscles are lost. And so the muscles of voluntary movement, things like speaking muscles, swallowing muscles, breathing muscles, muscles in the arms and legs, they lose their command center. They start to shrivel up or they become atrophic and people become weak. And unfortunately, this is a disease that moves, can move quickly. And over a short period of time, individuals with ALS develop really significant functional challenges. We don't have a cure for the disease, so we do not have a medication that effectively really stops or reverses this disease, and that's of critical need. ALS is a disease that affects about 2 out of every 100,000 people, so we think of it as fairly rare, but everyone seems to know somebody or know of somebody who knows somebody with ALS. So there's that connection there. Some people may say, you know, I never heard of this disease, but I learned of one person, and all of a sudden, wait, there's like 5 or 6 people that I know with ALS, and is this disease really rare? So it's a disease that's more common than we think. It's something that needs attention.
Go ahead, Kathy. Well, let me ask this very quickly.
I'm so scared because I actually have a distant family member who passed away recently from ALS. And I'm always just astounded, you know, that you say there's no cure and there's no nothing to really treat ALS to make it a manageable condition or anything like that. What's the deal? Why is it so difficult to come up with a cure or even a treatment for ALS?
Right. So I think it's really important. That's an excellent question. I think it's really important that we separate out two things. So one is medications that actually treat the causes of ALS that allow us to beat back the condition, the pathophysiologic changes that are leading to the loss of these motor neuron cells. From the second issue, which is how do we treat ALS symptomatically to improve quality of life and enjoyment of life, because those are two really separate issues. And so one of the things that I commonly hear is that, oh, well, there's no treatment for ALS, and that's not true. So we have really good therapies to improve symptomatic management. And people with ALS develop some functional impairments. And we've got adaptive equipment. We have things like power wheelchairs that can help people get around. We actually did a Facebook Live presentation not too long ago, I think within the last couple of months, through the ALS Association, where we had this opportunity to interact with people through Facebook Live, demonstrating the adaptive equipment that we have to improve quality of life. The therapy, non-invasive ventilation, perhaps a lot of people out there have heard of CPAP, where people wear masks at night when they sleep if they have obstructive sleep apnea. But this is a treatment that, when it's used in ALS, can extend life by over a year while also improving quality of life and improve fatigue and improve symptoms. So we've got really good therapies for improving the symptomatic management of ALS. So I think it's important that we separate out these two concepts. There are two drugs approved for the treatment of ALS to slow the disease down. They do a modest job. The first is Riluzole, also known as Rilutek, and that's been around for a long time. And there was a drug that was approved about a year ago from the FDA called Edaravone or Radicava. And these drugs have a modest effect on slowing the disease. But why don't we have better treatments right now? I think that's the critical question. Why don't we have better therapies that really stop ALS or reverse ALS? The disease is complex, and there are lots of mechanisms at the cellular level that contribute to ALS, And so what we're working on is trying to unravel all these different mechanisms to understand why are these cells susceptible to generating this damage that doesn't allow them to work correctly, and then how does this disease spread within the nervous system? So you get this area in the nervous system or in the brain or in the spinal cord where the ALS starts, and then what causes it to spread. And then on top of this, there are factors likely external in the environment that precipitate or lead to the progression in ALS, and that's one of the things that we're trying to figure out. So the challenge is, how do we unravel all of these complexities involved in the susceptibility of ALS, the progression of ALS, and then find those targets for us to engage with drugs or other therapies? So that's the challenge. It's getting at that cellular level and saying, what's happening? What are these 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 things that are happening, and how do we address each one of those effectively with some therapy?
Okay, Doc, great answers, great information. I saw some articles about Scotty and so forth, and do we need basically around $2 billion to find a cure for this? Is that the number I've seen? That's the estimate?
I don't know what the number is, but clearly there's more money that's needed for ALS research. We believe it's an underfunded disease.
Sure.
The advancement is medical technology allows us to discover a whole lot of new things. But what the biggest challenge is funding. And from somebody who does a lot of research like myself and our team here, I'm mentored by Dr. Eva Feldman, who's really been a leader in ALS research, and we have wonderful people who work with us here. We need more funding to allow us to expand the work that we do. And as we start learning more about the disease, there's just a lot more technologies that we can bring in to better understand it. So let me give you an example. We live in the state of Michigan, and Michigan has a higher rate of ALS than other parts of the country. The Midwest and Michigan have higher rates of ALS than other parts of the country. We don't really understand why. We think this is driven by contaminants in the environment, pollution or chemicals, and we're trying to understand how that connects to ALS. And so one of the things that we do here to understand this is we have a study where we enroll individuals with ALS, and they fill out information about where they've lived and where they worked. We get essentially a residential and occupational history, and we collect samples of blood from them and other biofluids that we can go and measure pollutants in, or look at metabolism, or look at changes in the way genes get turned on and off from the environment, or look at the immune system and how this relates to ALS. And you running that enterprise requires funding, and then doing all the experiments from this file repository, what we call it, is also costly. And so there's just a lot that we can do from the samples that we have, and it all requires funding. And so there's a great community out there of ALS researchers all across the country, and there's a lot of enthusiasm and excitement for all scrapping to get dollars to help us advance the research. So it's an underfunded disease, and that's why we work so hard in getting grants or looking towards individuals to help provide us funding from philanthropic sources so that we can progress the work that we do.
So, Doc, just to add to that, do you work on it? What do you do on like a day-to-day basis? Because as you and I always talk about, you're not a surgeon. But I know Dr. Chris Fox, our good friend here at Bees World, Kathy and I had him on last summer, one of our first podcast guests. He was one of the first people Scotty talked to, and he put Scotty in touch with U of M Hospital. I believe he put him in touch with you. So talk about on a day-to-day basis what your day is like and how Chris Fox and you and others are working together to get this thing taken down.
Sure. And you bring up an interesting point that I'll address maybe before I talk about my day-to-day life. It's amazing because on average, somebody takes a year from the onset of their symptoms to eventually get diagnosed with ALS. So their symptoms start, and they know there's a problem, and they don't get to the correct diagnosis for a year. And that's just because of the recognition of symptoms. And that's one of the things that we really need to work on, is improving recognition so that we can... So people are living in this state where they're saying, I don't know what I have. I know there's something wrong, but I don't know what it is.
So, how do we fix that? Because you've talked about causes like concussions and so forth, and the environmental thing you just talked about. So how do we fix that? So like what happened with Scotty, where, hey, he has Dr. Chris Fox, who's his teammate and his buddy, and he can say, hey, Scotty, that looks like ALS. You need to go get that checked. Is there a way we can go to our primary care physician, and they can give us a test to, you know, it's not like it's measles where it's obvious, or chicken pox. There's got to be a better way to figure this out. And you just said that's a huge part of getting this taken care of the best you can, is early detection.
Yeah, that's a fantastic question. And so...
I only ask fantastic ones, Doc. Come on.
Yep. I'm gathering that. So this is a huge challenge. So ALS is a disease that is rare. It's a rare disease than other more common things that we see. And so a lot of people may go throughout their whole career without ever having seen an individual with ALS in their practice. And so ALS starts, right? So how does ALS start? It may begin with some hand weakness. It may begin with some foot weakness. It may begin with some trouble with speaking or swallowing. And so it looks like other things. It just looks like something else. Maybe if it's the hand, you know, perhaps it's carpal tunnel syndrome. Or if it's a foot drop, maybe it's a pinched nerve in the back. And so these are the types of diagnoses that are chased. Sometimes it leads to surgeries that may not necessarily have led to an improvement in medical symptoms. So a back surgery or like a carpal tunnel brace, or thinking that it may be some, you know, acid reflux disease interfering with the voice. And so one of the key pieces of information that says this is worrisome for ALS is this idea of what we call painless progressive weakness, meaning that somebody's becoming weak and they don't have any changes in sensation. They're not saying my fingers are numb or tingling, or my foot's not numb or tingling, or I'm not having pain. And so these are some of the real critical pieces of historical information that my patients tell me that say, yes, this is clearly ALS. But we don't have a test that says, yes or no, this is ALS. And that's one of the other big challenges out there, because if I'm wondering, you know, do you have strep throat? You get your throat swabbed and it either grows the bacteria or it doesn't. Or if I want to know, is your iron level normal or not normal, we draw a blood test and we can see what it is. It's a very objective piece of information that's sitting right there for us to see. ALS is a clinical diagnosis. And so it's the matter of having the right person recognize it and identify it. And so the things that we need to work on are, one, awareness, what we're doing right now, talking today, but also this awareness in the medical community to say these are the symptoms that should prompt a referral to a neurologist to have this further addressed. And it's that painless progressive weakness. And so at that stage, then we can run the right clinical testing, rule out other causes, and arrive at the diagnosis more quickly. The reason why this is critically important is because we have a lot of good clinical trials going on right now with medications, and we think these medications are what we call neuroprotective, meaning that they can protect cells in the nervous system. And the earlier that these can be provided, we hypothesize that it'll be better, that we can preserve more populations of these motor neuron cells so that they don't die or die as quickly, and so it can extend life and improve symptoms longer term. So we have some work to do.
Yeah,
sure.
Yeah. So yeah, I saw something that really bothered me when I saw that we haven't really made much strides since when Lou Gehrig got this disease. I know you mentioned they added a new drug recently, but is that true, and how can we fix that?
Right. So it's a matter of untangling these complex mechanisms and forming these teams. You know, you're a sports guy, and we know that working as a team is critical. And you know, if you want to win the game or whatnot, you really need to operate as a team. And the same is true in medicine. And
sure.
You need teams of people that get together around these common themes and assemble to understand this disease. And we have an excellent team here at University of Michigan and other places of excellent teams. And then we work together across different campuses. And so we need to start untangling these complex mechanisms and diving deeper into how they each lead to the susceptibility of disease and incorporate newer technologies, new scientific technologies, so that we can begin to understand this idea of, you know, this idea of this precision medicine that we say, how do somebody's genetics, how does somebody's environment interplay with one another and lead towards the disease? What I think we're going to get to is this idea that we know to some extent what these personal, what these, you know, in general pathologic changes are of ALS. So we have some of these mechanisms that apply to everybody, but what are some of these additional factors that play a role? And then how do we target each one of these? And so there's very interesting developments in the scientific community, these things that we call induced pluripotent stem cells. So I can draw your blood and take those cells and essentially reverse engineer them into a stem cell that then we can do research on. We can understand how those cells, we reverse engineer them into a neuron or a neuronal cell, and we can look and see what's happening, what's making these cells act funny or weird and drive that cell towards a ALS-like pathology. And then you can use these cells in drug discovery and other mechanistic discoveries. So that's what's around today that wasn't around in the 1930s and 40s when Lou Gehrig was suffering from this disease. So
stem cells are really important then apparently for this type of thing.
Right. So what we call these induced pluripotent stem cells, where we can take tissue from you and reverse engineer it into something and do like a drug screen, for example. And so this is a promising area. And what we call these shotgun approaches to understanding how to target therapies. And I'm not talking about a football shotgun, play, but basically where we say we're looking at a large set of information here and how do we kind of do this, approach where we generate a lot of data and then try to figure out what's coming up as significant. Because that can lead us in new and interesting directions. If I look at, say, you know, 20 years ago, perhaps we'd say I'm going to look at one, two, or three things, and that's what the medical technology allowed me to do. And now I can take some of your blood and maybe look at 1,000 different markers. And I can do that with you, and it may be hard to sort out, but then if I add 100 more people or 1,000 more people or 5,000 more people, we can start to understand that we look at 1,000 pieces of data, but with 5,000 people, we can start honing in on what's critical. And this is where the collaborations are important and the teamwork in medicine is important. We can't solve this at any one place. We really need to work together collaboratively as an ALS research community. And so that's what we're doing, and that's where I think we're going to make strides. And certainly we're involved in research here that combines information from patients that choose to provide samples of blood to us into these larger data sets so that we can use these new medical technologies and say, what are new genes involved in ALS? How are these genes being modified by the environment? How are they being turned on or off? And, in ways that they should or maybe shouldn't be turned on or off? And how does the immune system change the way that ALS advances? And can we use existing drugs that are out there and approved for other conditions to help ALS? So that's the big change that we've seen in the last 100 years.
Gotcha. Doc, just out of curiosity, how did you get into ALS-specific research?
You're a smart guy.
John, yeah, you went to Johns Hopkins. Kathy, I stole it, sorry. How you got into this specifically, and can you talk about more about the event tonight with U of M hockey for Scotty and my turn?
Absolutely. So I think in medicine, we all follow in the footsteps of people who've mentored us, and when somebody who we work with closely as a trainee has an interest in a disease, I think it's common to sort of latch on to their interest, and that was no exception for me, and I had individuals who in medical school who influenced me towards a career in neurology when I was at University of Chicago. And then when I did both my residency and my fellowship in neuromuscular medicine at Cleveland Clinic, I was mentored by a really exceptional group of people who really led me into this area of neurology, into ALS specifically. And I was fortunate enough to be recruited to University of Michigan by Dr. Eva Feldman, who continues to mentor me and who is a leader in ALS and has allowed me to expand my career into this field. So I've been in a very fortunate position to be in this community and to be a caring individual in this community and treat patients and see people with ALS in research. So the event tonight, this is the third year where this has happened. This is really, you know, Scotty taking the lead on building awareness and using his connection with the hockey program. And we're really so appreciative of University of Michigan's hockey's interest in doing this because it's awareness that's critical. And we'll have a table set up and we'll have some information with us. We're happy to talk to whomever comes by the table. I think we have a couple of public address announcements where both myself and Dr. Feldman appear in a video just to give an overview of ALS. We hope that this expands and that we can continue to build awareness surrounding this disease and what it's all about and why we need more public attention for it.
It's just from my perspective, I mean, I was here with Scotty in school. Two of our radio color guys, Andrew Merrick, who you met the other night, and Bill Trainer, who are also teammates with Scotty, and Coach McCall, the U of M assistant coach, he was on the team with Scotty. So this is really a personal thing for me. And Maddie talked about Coach Berenson and Mel, and this is like a personal thing for a lot of us. Because, you know, when you see what Scotty's going through on a day-to-day basis, the videos are awful. And you know, Pete Frades, everybody knows about the Ice Bucket Challenge. And we need to do something about this, and you're doing a great job. Keep it up.
This is a challenging disease, and it hurts our hearts.
To put it mildly.
Yep. It hurts our hearts when we see somebody with this disease. And, you know, we haven't even touched upon the challenges of somebody living with this disease in our conversation. And so,
well, do it. Go ahead, please. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, I mean, to have somebody in their 20s or 30s or 40s get this disease with young kids, I mean, that is hard. Or to have somebody who said, I just retired, I've worked for 40 years, I'm going to go out, I'm going to travel, and then they get diagnosed with this disease. Our medical system is not set up to provide the care for people with this disease on a day-to-day basis. In other words, to say, you need help in your house. You need some caregivers. You need somebody to help you take a shower, get out of bed. And our insurance system doesn't cover this. And so this can lead to what we call caregiver fatigue, where your spouse or your friend or family member who's caring for somebody just gets tired. They have so many responsibilities. And I tell my patients that that we have to take care of you guys as a unit. If one of you is not healthy, both of you won't be healthy, because you need that advocate, you need that healthcare advocate, you need that person who's able to help you on a day-to-day basis, and we need to work to keep you both healthy. And we have to look at what we call the psyche. You know, how do you, facing this disease, stay happy, stay focused, know that there's a lot of good days in front of you for living? And this is some of the biggest challenges we face when there's just not that help to say, I need somebody to help me take a shower or to help prepare a meal. If you're young and you have this disease and your spouse still is working and they need to work so that there's money for the family, so that your kids can go to school and whatnot, that can create a financial challenge. If you've retired and you're living on a fixed income to have this disease and not have those resources. So there's a lot that needs to be done just in addition to the discovery about the disease, but just how do we as a society care for people with this disease who need the help and don't have these resources, and how do we take additional layers of care into the home so that people can continue to have their good quality of life. They can wake up in their home every morning. They can enjoy their friends and their families. How do we keep them from ending up in the hospital because there's not that team that can care for people in the home? So this is just another layer of complexity to the disease that we need to figure out, and that we just don't have a perfect system for right now. But it's of really a critical need. And so one of the aspects of advancing awareness for this disease is advocacy for this disease. How do we lead people to understand that this is a disease that needs recognition, because there's so many issues out there? It's not just finding better treatments, but how do we promote the advocacy to say we need a healthcare system that better addresses the needs for people and families living with ALS? How do we get medical equipment faster or not get tied down in authorizations for a certain medication? And I think if you talk to somebody who has ALS or whose family member has ALS, you realize the frustration in sort of navigating the medical system. And we want people to not be frustrated by navigating the medical system, but really to fully enjoy their days and to get quality out of their days and not feel like they're having to fight with insurance companies or healthcare systems.
Doc, we're going to let you go here in a minute, but I just want to say, you know, what you're dealing with, you're like Kathy's boyfriend, Baker Mayfield. You're on the Cleveland Browns and you're fighting an uphill battle. So what you do on a day-to-day basis is very mentally challenging, and, you know, it's little small battles where you win the war, and it takes a special guy to deal with that on a day-to-day basis. So it's really cool what you are doing and what Matt's doing. They're helping you, but it's really hard because you're in a real life game of life and death. It's not, hey, if we lose, we get beat in the playoffs. I'm a sports guy, as you mentioned. So it takes a special guy to do what you do, and I appreciate it. For Scotty and all the other people you're working and fighting for every day, I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you, and we really appreciate you allowing us to talk to you today and to
That's
use
right.
your...
What do I got to do? I mean, come on. I mean, there's nothing. I got nothing going on. Come on.
Well, you know, it's a football weekend. You know, Michigan's got a bye week. You know, we've got the bye week. But...
Yeah, well, it's like God gave me some time off because the Patriots play Monday night, so I got a very strange weekend for me, so... And most of the Patriots fans, friends, will tell you, we really do have a week off. We're playing the Bills. But but appreciate it. And I will be there tonight. I'll come by and see you and Matt. And Matt knows where I'm at. I'm in the press box. But the just unbelievable job. Is there anything else you need put out while you're here?
I think that's great, B. We really appreciate this. Yeah, we'll see you tonight. You'll see Dr. Gottman, Dr.
Come on,
Feldman.
Come on, Trevor. What do you think? I'd run a Mickey Mouse clown show? I got Kathy with me. Come on, man.
You know, we'll have a good hub out there for pregame, and I think she's going to do an in-arena interview. And if anybody's listening to listen to the game, I think Dr. Feldman's going to join Al Randall once again. So we really do, as Dr. Gottman already put it, we really do appreciate the entire athletic department, really, and even going up to Doug Ganaki and Ward Manuel, really supporting this event and everything that happens at Michigan Medicine as well. There's so many great things that happen here in Michigan, and it's great that athletics really allows to come out, the whole university's benefit.
You turned out okay, Trevor, for a hockey guy. You know, you're doing okay.
Thanks a lot. I'll see you tonight.
Okay, buddy.
Yeah, thank you guys so much.
Thank you, Doc. Bye-bye.
All right, thanks. See you guys later.